I was asked to mention to you, which I'm very glad to do, that there is a wonderful, though idiosyncratic, film about a production of The Tempest called Shakespeare Behind Bars by a company that actually performs within a prison in Kentucky. Yeah, is this right? The film is, we showed it in another course that we all taught together, and we were really very struck by it. What's interesting about it is both the very skilled performances of some of the inmates and also the often ironic, often very moving, often surprisingly over-appropriate connection between the characters played by some of these people within this correctional facility and the stories that they tell about their own lives. It's a documentary, it's quite good, it's completely optional. You should not watch it in place of reading The Tempest. You will not see an entire production of The Tempest, I don't think, but you will see an interesting contemporary conversation that involves a Renaissance play, the notion of Shakespeare, a correctional institution, a very gifted director who comes from outside, and some residents of this correctional facility for whom Shakespeare and performing in Shakespeare is something very close to a kind of salvation. So if this is the kind of thing that interests you, this one is very well done. And you can rent it, you can buy it, you presumably can access it in other electronic ways about which I know nothing. So that's just an extra tip for you. Are we performing? We are performing. We are performing, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. So somebody said to me last time, not as a criticism, you know who you are, who said this to me, you always begin by saying how much you like this play. And I said, well, because it's always true. In other venues, I have been asked by people, you know, which is my favorite Shakespeare play, and my answer, which sounds like an evasion but isn't, is whichever one I'm reading or writing about or teaching at the present time. This is genuinely, absolutely true. I just fall in love with these plays over and over again every time I engage with them. There are also plays, and there have been a couple this semester, in which I worried a little bit that you guys might not have fallen in love on first read or first encounter, and there were a couple of people who, you know, wrote to Mel to say maybe Measure for Measure wasn't the moment of Shakespeare that they would remember forever, though I think it's a brilliant play. And there have been people not in this class, very distinguished scholars at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, who thought, as I mentioned to you, that Pericles and Cymbeline might be Shakespeare in his dotage, or Shakespeare losing interest in human character, or something like that. I greatly, enormously admire those plays, and I wanted to underscore that fact to you. Now we come to The Tempest, to the Winter's Tale, and here I have to tell you that when I was an undergraduate, there were two plays that I read for the first time. There were other plays that I read for the first time, but there were two plays that I read for the first time that completely blew me away, and that probably made me, for better or for worse, the Shakespearean I am today, or I will be tomorrow, or I was yesterday. And these plays were plays about which I knew nothing prior to taking a course in Shakespeare. And one of them was Antony and Cleopatra, and the other one was The Winter's Tale. And I just found these plays amazing, and I still find them amazing. So when I say to you that I really like this play, I mean this in an absolute sense, and not even in a comparative sense. I just think this play is absolutely dazzling. As a piece of stagecraft, as a piece of character analysis, as a piece of poetry, as a piece of staging, as a piece of everything, as a piece of Shakespeare, I just think it's amazing. So I'll probably talk to you very badly about it because my enthusiasms will overrun any analytic qualities that I might have. I do want to make sure that we talk about a number of different moments in the play. But let me I'll make sure of that. And if I need to, I'll sort of write them on the board at the break. But in the meantime, I want to sort of elicit from you, as I try usually to do, some sense of where you think this play fits and what is striking about it. Let us start, if we can, with some similarities, some ways in which this play resembles, first, the other romances that we have looked at. Let's don't think back to the tragedies for a second. Just stick with Pericles and with Cymbeline. What does this play have in common with Pericles and or Cymbeline? Yes?
Recognition scenes.
Recognition scenes, absolutely, absolutely. In this case, between whom, who and who? Between who and who? Yes.
I was thinking of Cymbeline and Pericles with the daughters and the fathers.
Yes, exactly.
And the same with the Winter's Tale. You have the daughter and the father.
Right. Yeah. Right. Do we actually see the recognition scene between the daughter and the father?
Not in Winter's Tale. You don't.
Right. Right. So where in Pericles, the father-daughter recognition scene is the centerpiece of recognition. And then they both travel to Ephesus, and they meet Thaisa, and they again have a recognition, but it's subordinated to the father-daughter one. In this case, it's the other way around, that the recognition between the father and the long-lost daughter is retold, we have the evidence, the kind of classic pastoral evidence of the wrappings in which the baby was swaddled and the coins and all the other things that are belong to the world of romance and fairy tale. But this all retold to us in the second act of the second scene of the last act, so as to foreground the husband-wife reunion and indeed the daughter-mother reunion that takes place in that inexpressibly magical recognition scene, which is the statue scene in Pauline's gallery, as it's called. So recognition scenes, absolutely. And these are, again, these are elements that are very, very common within romance, because there's disguise and there's, you know, you're shining through your disguise in the same way that the boys in Cymbeline were so noble that their nobility shone through their humble upbringing and so forth. But there's a kind of apotheosis or epiphany, a kind of moment of recognition that is almost religious, and especially in this play, almost religious. And there's also this sense that we talked about last time, it's so important, all these plays, where cognition and recognition are versions of the same, where finding and refinding are versions of the same, where you, to use a formula that I often use about all of Shakespeare's plays, the comedies especially, but also it functions here, you lose yourself to find yourself. In this case, and that's what happens in the comedies when they go into the woods or away from the court or whatever it is. They disguise, they're persecuted, so they can't be the noble people that they are back in the so-called real world, and so they get in touch with their inner selves or with their better selves or with their other selves. So here, too, there is a recognition that, in this case, is a restoration, where you don't see the parting exactly. The baby leaves through ways that we'll describe. The Hermione is said to die and is whisked away, and we don't know. We don't know. This is a complete surprise to us, too. This is the way in which the register of this play differs from the register of almost every other play, is that things are kept from us. And, you know, this is a breaking of a contract. We thought we always knew. Edgar talked to us, or Iago talked to us, or Gower talked to us, or somebody talked to us and said, don't worry, something's going to happen, it'll be okay, hang in there. Not here. Not here. And in fact, there are some actual losses. Who's really lost in this play? Who doesn't recover? Mamilius, yes. Anybody else? Antigonus, okay. So people we have met do die. This is different from what happens in Shakespearean comedy, if I can make so definitive a statement, but I think it's empirically going to turn out to be the case. We hear about people dying in the comedies. Ragozine, that pirate whose head becomes the substitute head for the head of Claudio in Measure for Measure. You'll remember Ragozine, of course. In the early comedies, there are sisters who die, whom we never meet, and so forth. The play is circumscribed by the possibility of death. Death is the frame. Death is the margin. Death is the thing that brings the play literally to life for us. In these plays, people actually die. And they die, I think, in part because the entire play is about this process of bringing back to life. And so you'll have the natural cycle. Remember that with Cymbeline, we had the jewels on the one hand and, you know, natural things that lived and died on the other hand. You'll see this very, very profoundly in this play as well, that there are things that happen because of the cycle of nature, things that seem to somehow transcend that, that are eternal in that they are jewels or other things that don't seem to destruct. But the recognition scene becomes a finding, not only of the lost other, but also of life itself. Not only of yourself, but also of life itself. We saw this with Pericles, where he was, you remember, in a kind of living death, that he let his hair grow, that he had opted out of life, that he was in a situation which we would call very low affect. He had absolutely no response to anybody. And what brought him back from this almost catatonic, marginal state was love, was recognition, was refinding. In this case, the situation of Leontes is not so performatively dire. We do not see him actually, we do see that he is living in a diminished state, but he's not dysfunctional. He's just very much not happy. And what comes back to him in these gifts is something really amazing. So recognition, sorry to go on about this so long, but recognition scenes, what else do these plays have this play have in common with the other two romances?
There's the element of magic. So in Pericles, you have the rebirth of Thaisa.
Yes.
In Cymbeline, you have the rebirth of Imogen, who isn't really dead and then wakes up. And then the rebirth of Hermione in this play.
Okay, great. Perfect. Anything else?
You have the duality of location with the
yes.
very different characters in each of the locations is similar with Cymbeline and Pericles and
right.
Winter's
Tale. In Cymbeline and Pericles, you have more peripatetic. You have more different locations. Now we're a little bit back to the old comic structure, which since we haven't read this kind of comedy in here, we haven't really visited, of, for example, the court, the country, and the court. Which is a one standard comic structure where, remember I wrote the word liminal on the board last week and I said that this was a term from Victor Turner, the anthropologist who's interested in dramas as social movements and so forth, that you would go to a place that was a place of threshold or of margin or of possibility. In this case, this is literalized in this impossible location, the seacoast of Bohemia, a place that currently at least has no seacoast, though again you'll find critical articles that say, in that time, Bohemia actually had a seacoast, here it is. It's a fairy place. It's a place of the imagination. And it is a coast, it is a shoreline, a place between earth and water. And it's on those boundaries that things always happen. Like the boundary of life and death, where you see a ghost, so also on a boundary like this, something will happen. In this case, what happens, of course, is that the baby is deposited on the shore and then discovered on the shore. So that death and rebirth happen exactly on that same borderline, where in other places death and rebirth are themselves a kind of borderline. So we have, what are the two places? What are the names of the two places that we have? Sicilia and Bohemia. And how early in the play do we actually learn that there are these two places and that they differ from one another? First scene, absolutely. Another should be recognizable to you from so many of the plays that we've looked at. A scene in which characters who seem like secondary characters, though in fact both of these characters are going to assume a considerable importance here, but remember Philo and Demetrius at the beginning of Antony and Cleopatra, talking about the dotage of their general, Antony, and how he was in love with Cleopatra, and so you didn't see Antony or Cleopatra till after you heard this whole story. Here too we have this story, an exchange between two apparently secondary characters. Who are they? Camillo and Archidamus, right? Okay. Discussing the difference between the two lands, and as with Antony and Cleopatra, so also here, name of the land is the name of the king. So you hear about Sicilia or Bohemia, these are names of places, but they're also the titles of persons in the way that you would say England speaks when the King of England speaks or something. So it's a figure of speech. But it becomes crucially important because, as happened with Pericles, so also will happen here, the land, the behavior of the land will mirror the psychic situation of the of its king. So, indeed. And what is the difference between Sicilia and Bohemia?
One's very civilized and courtly, and the other is almost idyllic in its non-class system, and everybody's sort of back to nature. I mean,
this is absolutely correct. Do we have that sense from the very beginning of the play?
No, but you mean quickly. I don't know. I watched one of the plays, and they over. It's over. I guess exaggerated in some of the plays. I mean,
the
produced some of
the.
Yeah. I mean, they over exaggerate the courtliness of.
Yeah, exactly. It's a kind of hyper civil. Because the idea here is in part, and we saw this in King Lear too, that it's when you really think you're civilized and sophisticated that the barbaric comes out. That it's that veneer of we are civilized, we are court, we are aesthetic, and we are political, and we are this involvement in being so correct and being so advanced that allows immediately to come out that which you are so hastily covering over. But indeed, which is the super civilized, which is the urban, which is the hierarchical, as you quite
Sicilia.
So why do we say hierarchical? What's hierarchical about it?
Well, it's a definite class system. I mean, the top guy is the top guy, and their children don't marry. I mean, actually, in Bohemia, that doesn't happen either, because I mean, the father didn't want.
Right.
And to marry the shepherdess, but
right.
But I mean, there's much more structure in it.
There's a king. There's
yeah.
there's a court. There are servants. There are attendants. There you have again this full panoply of the Renaissance world, whatever the time period actually is of this thing. You have that sense of empowered and embodied kingship, and the conversation is really about hospitality. It's about sort of when you come to visit us, gosh, we don't know how we're going to be able to entertain you because there's such fancy food and such fancy entertainments and so forth. Well, we'll give you sleepy drinks. We'll give you drugs to pretend so you won't notice how rough and rude things are in our home place. But so that we have both, and this is structurally really important here, I'll get to you in just one second, that you have an equality, Sicilia, Bohemia, and you also have a contrast. And we saw this with Othello, with Venice and Cyprus. We saw it with Rome and Egypt. You're going to have this apparent dyad where there is a good deal of Bohemia inside Sicilia and a good deal of Sicilia inside Bohemia, and they've kind of come out, because we'll see, as you suggested, that the king of Bohemia is actually pretty hierarchical and pretty hidebound when it comes to notions about who you should marry and things like that. That it's not as if the cultures are completely different, but indeed we meet different populations also. When we finally get to Bohemia, we see the shepherdess and the clown and the shepherd and the bear, and we see a whole different kind of population.
I just kind of made a connection, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought it was really interesting how at the end of the play, when they come back to Sicilia, everybody seems to know about it, and word travels very quickly, but when Perdita is dumped on the shores, there's a boat that comes with that, and maybe you can correct me, but nobody really seems to even notice that she's there, or that a boat has come to their shores, or does there, I don't
Well, there's a shipwreck, isn't that right?
Right.
So how close does the boat actually come to the shore?
Well, I mean, he comes to shore, though,
right.
Doesn't he?
Right.
So
right.
I just think it's. So are you saying they're definitely? I can't remember now.
Who would you think would have noticed this?
I just think that if somebody had come and crashed on their shore, that the king would have found out somehow, especially because it's
important. I don't know because we don't see. I mean, for the king doesn't inhabit this. Wasteland part of. I mean, he's presumably he has a castle, a throne room, whatever it is that kings in this era have, and he's in it because when he does come to this part of Bohemia, he's disguised as a shepherd. and that he arrives, and Camillo arrives also disguised, and they are given country hospitality, and they are charmed by the beautiful shepherdess who turns out to be Polixenes' daughter and so forth. But they're nowhere near, I mean, I don't think we have any sense of what the communication system would be here. We don't have, as there is in Antony and Cleopatra, for example, a messenger system where you would exactly expect that a battle won or a battle lost would make its way back to Alexandria, somebody would learn about it. But don't think we have that here. What we have is immediacy, and the immediacy, again, of a certain kind of dream. Yes.
Once again, we have children without a full complement of parents. And Perdita is particularly interesting because, in fact, she does have two parents, but she's only brought up by one. She's brought up by the old shepherd, and there is no Mrs. Old Shepherd.
No Mrs. Shepherd, yes,
and,
exactly.
And Florizel only has his father. So functionally, neither one of them has a full complement of
exactly,
parents.
Exactly, exactly, yes. Right. And so what is restored here is what we could call, very unhistorically, the nuclear family. I mean, the notion of the nuclear family is a 19th century notion, but she is restored to the father and the mother at once, as also happens with Marina. But you're quite right. There's this dissymmetry where we have shepherd and clown, and we have there's no Mrs. Polixenes either. There's no Mom Polixenes floating around, where there is, quite troublingly, a Mrs. Leontes. So we have the two guys and the girl situation as the setup in the middle of the first act of the play. But I think that's great. That's very well observed. Yes. So there's still on things that this play has that are similar with romances.
I mean, jealousy is a major thing. But could you, it comes, you know, is this in Cymbeline? It was in...
So in Cymbeline, it's, what's his name? Well, Posthumus. Posthumus is jealous, right? The husband.
Yeah, the husband. Right. Yeah. But in obviously in this one, I mean, but why does Shakespeare dwell on jealousy so much? I mean, the sense of supersensitivity in this one, but the other ones too. I mean, where just a mention is made, and the men absolutely grasp this thing and just go off the deep end with jealousy. You know, every woman can be cuckolded.
Right.
I mean, they just believe that this is possible and probably true.
The characters do.
Yeah.
I can't answer why Shakespeare does it. I can't. I mean, But it happens a lot. It happens in Othello, which is the play obviously being, you know, quoted and compressed here. It happens, as you say, with Posthumus. It's one of the arguments that is made is paternal undecidability, that you cannot tell if you're the father. This is the pre-DNA moment, that this is actually your child. Exacerbated in this case because the child inherits. So this is, you know, one rationalization for this. I could make you an answer that would sound very flippant, but I don't mean it to be flippant, which is to say that jealousy is wonderfully theatrical, that it performs very well, that it is highly recognizable as a negative emotion, negative affect, as we say, that people have, that both Leontes' speech, which I will look at, of jealousy, and we did look at Posthumus' speech, and certainly Othello's speeches about jealousy, are very recognizable psychic states, even though these are 17th century characters, and we are living several hundred years after them. It's very dramatic, and it's very it produces anger and loss. I don't know why the playwright does this, but he does it very frequently. And he does it in Much Ado About Nothing, and he does there. It's in lots and lots of Shakespeare plays, some comedies, some histories, some tragedies, some romances. And here, as you say, turns on a dime. The you know, is whispering nothing, is horsing, you know, kissing cheek to cheek, horsing slow together, whatever it is that we'll look at this passage in which he really makes something of nothing. He really, they say, oh, it's nothing. And he has a whole narrative about why, indeed, this must be proof positive that there's a relationship between these two people. I've seen productions in which directors have tried actually to make that plausible, in which there is some byplay between Hermione and Polixenes, and the, you know, the paddling with your, his palms with your damn fingers, this question of sort of whether her courtliness, which after all the husband says, persuade him to stay. I don't want him to go. Persuade him to stay. And we should back up a little bit and talk about that. Let's look for a second at the twin lamb speech, which is the speech that establishes the relationship between these two people in Act 1, Scene 2, the prehistory of the relationship between Polixenes and Leontes. This is about line 63, really, in the text that I have. The Polixenes is beginning. Now, how long has Polixenes been in Bohemia? In Sicilia? I'm sorry.
9 months.
Okay, I picked the number out of the air. I don't know. Been there for 9 months, and he's beginning to feel as if he's really stayed away too long. Now, if he were King Lear, we would have said, 1 month is too long. Go home and take care of business in your kingdom. But in fact, we don't have any sense that, you know, there are revolts in Bohemia, that the, you know, they're being overrun by neighboring countries. We don't have that tremendous political sense of the urgency to go home. But nonetheless, we do have, and there must be a Mrs. Polixenes because we've got baby Polixenes. So there is this kind of go home. And Leontes tries to persuade his wife Hermione to keep Polixenes from going back to where we might think he belongs. That it's hard to know where he belongs since we first met him out of place, so to speak. So I want to look from about line 60, where she, trying to play this role of good hostess, and again, we've seen dangerous hosting situations in other plays. Remember Lady Macbeth as the good hostess here, saying, "Not your jailer then, but your kind hostess. Come, I'll question you of my lord's tricks and yours when you were boys. You were pretty lordings then," she asks. "You were, you know, cute guys." "We were, fair queen, two lads that thought there was no more behind but such a day tomorrow as today and to be boy eternal." Well, let's just stop right there. What does a suggestion like that say to you now that you're experienced Shakespeareans? No tomorrow, no yesterday. Such a day tomorrow as today, and to be boy eternal. Good thing, bad thing, scary thing? Yes?
I would say trouble is coming.
Yes, and why would you say that? You would be right.
because they can't be boys eternally.
Right, right.
It's not possible. And... So one feels uneasy, I think.
Right. Eternal is always... eternal cities, maybe. Eternal people, no. There's the natural round. There's life, there's death. Being a boy forever, as we've seen when Lear wanted to unburden, crawl toward death, when people want especially to cease to be and to not assume their roles in a complicated adult world, always precisely a danger signal. So boy eternal. Remember the word boy also in Coriolanus, that this is, it's a stage, but if it's a stage that an adult has, it's really a problem. Was not my lord the verier wag of the two? What does that phrase, verier wag, mean?
Greater rascal.
Yeah, exactly, greater rascal, good. Waggish wit. And here we have this gorgeous passage from Polixenes. "We were as twin lambs that did frisk in the sun and bleat the one at the other. What we changed, that is, exchanged with one another, was innocence for innocence. We knew not the doctrine of ill-doing, nor dreamed that any did." What's the doctrine of ill-doing?
Original
sin. Okay. "Had we pursued that life, and our weak spirits ne'er been higher reared with stronger blood, we should have answered heaven boldly, not guilty. The imposition cleared hereditary hours. Well, this is complicated language. Somebody want to paraphrase this for me? What does the imposition cleared hereditary hours mean? Yes, please.
Original sin, the imposition, the hereditary hours is original sin, and the fact is that if they had stayed in that their original friendship state, they would have cleared that. That would not have been the situation.
So again, if they were boy eternal, they would be like Adam without Eve, really, in the garden. They would be in a pure state. An unfallen, untempted state. That is the nostalgia of this moment. When they were like twin lambs that did frisk in the sun. Lamb here, maybe an overdetermined kind of animal. With what discourses do you associate lambs? That's a complicated way of putting it. In what kinds of imaginative worlds do we find lambs? Sorry? In Eden, yes, I guess, though I don't actually remember the lambs, but yes. They.
And also, is it in Isaiah, the lion?
Lion and lamb lying down together, okay, good. So, in the Bible, okay, so in the Bible, what's a lamb?
Innocence.
It's innocence, it's sacrificial, it becomes that which dies in order that something else shall live. These lambs, which come out of an imaginary pastoral landscape in which they're imagining, again, the countryside, you know, lambs skipping about. We're about to run into some shepherds a few acts from now who actually have lambs, or also lambs waiting for the slaughter, lambs waiting for the sacrifice, lambs waiting for them. So all of that, because of this religious language about the original sin, is impacted in this little pastoral image of the lamb. I hasten to say that polixenes is probably not consciously. How does a literary character have a consciousness? There's no sense in the surround of this that Polixenes thinks of himself as talking about biblical scripture. It's not that he is sending a complicated message. The message is coming through what he says to us. So just as we thought, uh-oh, when we heard about the boy eternal, so we might think, lambs, when we hear about the lambs. And we're going to see those lambs again in this pastoral space in which they're just lambs, whatever a just lamb is. But a lamb is very much a Christological animal, an animal that points toward sacrifice and salvation. And the innocence that he says that they swapped with one another, the unfallenness, is also his innocence with respect to the deeper knowledge of what it is that he has to say. So he is describing to her an unfallen state of playfulness, eternity, innocence, in which these all day long, these two young boys, played together without thinking about tomorrow or yesterday. Then what happened?
Puberty,
okay. There we go. I don't believe the word ever shows up in Shakespeare, but it definitely shows up in the next two lines. By this we gather, you have tripped since. Tripped, fallen. Oh, my most sacred lady. Notice how religious his language is. Temptations have since then been born to us. Notice, if you will, the relative passive construction here. It's not we have been tempted, but temptations have since then been born to us. For in those unfledged days was my wife a girl. So here she is, the cameo, Mrs. Polixenes. Your precious self had then not crossed the eyes of my young playfellow. So here we are. It's women who caused the fall. Surprise! But it's so gently done. It's so playfully done. This is flirtatious. This is, you know, the entire thing is a flirtation. What changed you from being boys to being men and kings? Well, love, marriage, desire, puberty, as you say. And he is revisiting in this little conversation a moment of meeting a desirable and tempting woman who isn't the same desirable and tempting woman as the one that he's talking to right now. you can see why the onlooker husband might watch this little replay and think that it was a certain kind of byplay or foreplay or courtship. What's being described here is a moment of erotic kindling, erotic awakening. And it's being told as if it happened in the past, but it's being observed by the third party here, Leontes, as if it is happening right now. And notice how quickly Leontes becomes jealous. It's another, 50 lines or so. The little flirtation continues. Is he won yet? Won. He'll stay, my lord. At my request, he would not. Hermione, my dearest, thou never spokest to better purpose. Never? Never but once. And of course, what's the once? What's the one time that she spoke to better purpose?
When she accepted him.
Okay. So again, this is seen as a kind of replay of that originary moment of finding your beloved or finding your desired and having your desired one desire you. But once before I spoke to the purpose, when? Nay, let me have it. I long. Now again, think of this as sexy, as byplay, as flirtatious. Think of her as not seeing this, just the way that Desdemona doesn't see it, as being scrutinized by somebody who is double reading it. Why? That was when 3 crabbed months had soured themselves to death ere I could make thee open thy white hand and clap thyself, my love. Then didst thou utter, I am yours forever. Well, here it's quite unfair to remember that moment when Iago says this to Othello, but I can't help doing so nonetheless. This is, of course, the marriage vow, the vow of perfect love and of, again, this is a different forever. This is, remember the forever of boy eternal, this is a different forever. This is a forever of going into the future rather than of having no temporality at all. I am yours forever. Tis grace indeed, lo you now, I have spoken to the purpose twice, the one forever earned a royal husband, the other for some while a friend. So, I mean, as I read it to myself, I think, well, why wouldn't he be jealous? It's the same thing all over again. She's twinning them. He's twinning them. He's put her up to it. And now he's sorry. Giving her hand to Polixenes, says my stage direction in square brackets, which means that it's not Shakespearean necessarily. But we've had just seconds ago, Leontes talking about how long 3 crabbed months souring themselves to death. Not what you think about when you think about a lover. 3 happy months that went until her white hand took his. So, Leontes. Too hot, to mingle friendship far as mingling bloods. I have tremor cordis on me, trembling of the heart. My heart dances, but not for joy, not joy. This entertainment may a free face put on, derive a liberty from hardiness, from bounty, fertile bosom, and well become the agent. May, I grant, but to be paddling palms and pinching fingers as now they are, and making practice smiles as in a looking glass, and then to sigh as for the mort of the deer, the death of the deer. That is entertainment. My bosom likes not, nor my brows. Now, why don't his brows like this? Cuckold horns, exactly. He already, by the end of this scene, he is feeling like a cuckold. Mamilius, art thou my boy? Mamilius is the son. Art thou my boy? I, my good lord. And now we have the beginning of his beginning to doubt whether either of his children really are his. Are you my child? Come, Sir Page, look on me with your welkin eye. The scene of jealousy here is a scene of such compression, such concision, that it doesn't really, I mean, I've read the previous scene to you to show you some of the clues that Leontes, or the actor playing Leontes, might well pluck out as evidence here. But it happens so quickly that almost always in a production, it seems as if it's just come out of nowhere. I mean, I've tried to show you some evidence from where it might have come from, but still the sense is of a kind of thunderclap, of something happening a scene of hospitality and welcome and brotherly love turning itself immediately around and becoming its opposite, a scene of brotherly hate, a scene of desperate competition around this unwitting woman. All of this, again, in the second scene of the play. So the pastoral, actually, is with us long before we get to Act 4 of this play, before we get to Bohemia. But it's this religious pastoral again, and it's the pastoral that carries with it the foreboding of loss, of death, of the necessity of rebirth. When we see the pastoral again, we'll actually see shepherds and actually see sheep, and we'll be in a slightly different situation. What else, just before we move from here to another passage, what else structurally is similar between this play and, let us say, Pericles? Very striking structure of the play, big structure of the play. Yes?
The gap between 14 years to permit another generation to grow up.
Yeah, I think, isn't it 16 in this
16
one?
Years,
16 in this one.
Can you repeat that?
Yes, the gap of 16 years in the middle of the play that permits, as you very well say, the second generation to grow up, to court, to marry. So we saw this in Pericles, where the baby Marina was born at sea, and then she was a young woman being taken by pirates and winding up in the brothel and so forth. So here also, the end of the first movement of the play, so to speak, ends up with the placing of the baby Perdita on the shore, and the finding of the baby by the old shepherd and the clown. And then there's a gap of, in this case, 16 years that eventuates in the grown-up Perdita, ready for courtship, ready for marriage, and indeed, as it turns out, also the grown-up Prince Florizel, the son of Polixenes, available to marry her. So we have this gap. What happened to the gap in Cymbeline?
It happened before.
Happened before. The boys were stolen away, and they're already grown up. And you'll see with the Tempest, a very similar thing happens, that there was a Tempest 12 years before the play begins. And so Miranda was then a baby and is now, again, a marriageable young woman. But in all of these plays, they deal with this question of how to produce the second generation. From a point of view of an actor, we have, in every single one of these cases, to think about whether the second generation in the second half of the play might be portrayed by the actress or the actor who played the figure of the first generation in the first half of the play. In other words, when Leontes looks at, in that incest scene at the end of this play, when Leontes first beholds the beautiful Perdita and thinks, gee, I'd like that one, before he gets told that he's actually on the wrong track, you might want to think about whether, meta-theatrically, the audience could see if the actress who had played the adult Hermione is now playing the adult Perdita, that in fact he was half recognizing something in the two of them that then would become, that in fact it's not only incest, but it's also a kind of half recognition of the relationship between the daughter and the wife, even though he doesn't know that the wife is still alive. In any case, these possibilities, these nested possibilities, are present in the play because of this gap of time. In Pericles, how did we handle the gaps? Who helped us over the gaps, so to speak? Who helped us not to mind the gaps? Gower, right, absolutely. How do we get over the gap in the middle of this play? Time, figure of time. Again, a choric figure, I time, I'm a chorus. We're familiar with choruses by now. We'll maybe look at his passages. But in any case, we have a figure who kind of comes out and says, by the way, it's now 16 years later, and I'm going to help you leap over this time. And it's like the use of the prologues and choruses in Romeo and Juliet or in Henry V, where it's time and space, both of them, are being manipulated by the choric figure, who says, through me, these changes are happening, stick with me, use your own imagination, I'm going to show you how to get from the one place to the other. So instead of, and these are, you know, gross violations of what some in the Renaissance at least thought were the unities, the supposed unities that of time, space, and action that Aristotle was said to have ordained. Here, both time and space are wildly disunified. but not psychically disunified, because as we'll see, the same thing keeps happening over and over again, that the action of losing and finding, of dying and being reborn, is the action that contains these things, one after the next. So we have a coming together, a history of the previous 9 months. So again, the play begins a little bit in medias res. It begins not quite at the beginning. There is a look back slightly at the earlier part of the happy visit between the two kings. And then we have the jealousy of Leontes. What happens after Leontes' jealousy? What are the elements in the plot that immediately seem to take place after that? Yes? Sorry?
The son and the wife die.
Son and the wife die, yes. Really bad punishment for feeling jealous. Is it only jealousy that produces this, or what's the sequence? Yes.
Trial. Hermione is tried.
Yes.
Breaking the marriage vows.
Right.
Yeah, adultery.
And what's the evidence?
Leontes' view of her paddling her hands and stuff like that. I don't think he has any real evidence.
What about the oracle? When does the oracle come in?
Oh, the oracle, yes, and he chooses to ignore the oracle.
Yes, very bad thing to
very
do.
Bad.
Never ignore an oracle.
Very bad.
It's that, you know, that's the moral of the play. Never ignore an oracle. Yes.
Also, Polixenes has left town.
Yes.
Polixenes has left town, and this encourages him to think he's guilty. So.
Right. There's no witness on the other side. There's no, exactly. Polixenes has left town. Tell me a little bit, before we get to the wife, tell me a little bit about the son. Tell me about Mamilius and the relationship of Mamilius to the mother and to the father. Yes?
He's a very sick child.
Sick?
Well, I don't know.
Sickly?
Sickly, yeah.
Why do you think that?
Well, the production I saw, he's in a wheelchair.
Oh, my goodness. I see. I wheelchair, like, what was the other word I thought was not in Shakespeare at all?
Yeah,
right, yeah. Okay.
But I mean, I think they do play him, and here there's some indication that he's not not that well.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like the production is a little bit naturalizing his death.
Yeah.
That, because it does, you know, it seems again to come out of nowhere. It seems to be unmotivated, except through you know, psychic pain. And so it sounds as if the production was trying to make it more plausible that this child...
Well, most importantly, he's the heir. I mean, that's... and with the oracle saying, I forget exactly what, you can't get your life straightened out without the heir.
Yeah.
They can't remarry.
Right.
He becomes the king.
We need to lose the heir. That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, I just don't... remember, if I'm remembering correctly about a footnote, but did he not, Leontes did not want Hermione to nurse him, and he was, and that's part of his name?
I'm sorry that you did nurse him, I think.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, obviously, it's past nursing right. At this point, but yes, and his name is connected to the Latin word for breast.
Right.
So he seems to be connected to the mother's world. And to be, mama's boy is the wrong kind of phrase here, but to belong to the, I mean, we have clues that he may not grow up, that he may not sort of move over into the world.
And that he was very jealous of him as well.
Ah, that's possible. That's possible. Yeah. Are we reaching our, okay, all right, good. I want to show you just another passage of Leontes' jealousy again, because the text is so wonderful. About line 185 in the same scene, gone already, inch thick, knee deep, or head and ears a forked one. That's me. Go play, boy, play. Thy mother plays, and I play too, but so disgraced apart, whose issue will hiss me to my grave. Contempt and clamor will be my knell. Go play, boy, play. There have been, or I am much deceived, cuckolds ere now, and many a man there is, even at this present, now, while I speak this, holds his wife by the arm, that little thinks she has been sluiced in his absence, and his pond fished by his next neighbor, by Sir Smile, his neighbor. Nay, there's comfort in it, whilst other men have gates, and those gates opened as mine against their will. Should all despair that have revolted wives, the tenth of mankind would hang themselves. physic for it, there is none. It's a body planet that will strike where 'tis predominant. And then comes this little conversation in which he says, Milius, am I like you? How now, boy, I am like you, they say, why, that's some comfort. I am like you means I look like you. And this is important because we're going to get to that ocular proof moment in which Paulina shows up with the baby and says, look at the face, it looks just like yours, and he can't see it. But the language of his jealousy is so, I mean, these kind of strong staccato, inch thick, knee skin, whatever it is, knee deep, or head and ear is a forked one, the kind of the way in which he is enjoying his disgrace, the way in which he is feeling this, the strong pain of this, he's already completely convinced. And what happens here, and I don't want to overstate it a little bit, I will overstate it and you can roll it back, there's a way in which he falls in love with his jealousy. There's a way in which he will not give his jealousy up. That when these evidences come from another direction, he does not. He would rather be right. He would rather not have to repent or recant his emotional commitment to this affect. It's not that he brings it upon himself exactly, but that he has, there are moments along this continuum where he could stop, and he doesn't. And so the repentance into which he finds himself thrown at the end is really a result of action, not only of the jealousy, but of the actions that he takes and doesn't take as a result of that. And that's part of what the trial scene tries to, I mean, again, a trial about erotic jealousy, it's the wrong venue. Send to the oracle, it's the wrong evidence. When the oracle comes, what's its language like? Simple. Very simple. Anybody remind me of some of the passages? Anybody find this passage quickly? Yes, please.
Something. Never mind. I don't know.
And the king will live without an heir till that which is lost has been found. But it's, you know, Camille's a true subject. That's what it says. Camille's a true subject. The very simple declarative. Now, oracles are supposed to be riddles. You're supposed to sort of say something enigmatic that you can't figure out. You think to yourself, oh my, I need a priest, I need a soothsayer to figure out what it is. This oracle speaks in subtitles. This oracle just, and it's in contradistinction to this extremely twisted language that we get from Leontes. Now, I said a couple of weeks ago that the romances, by and large, flatten out or expand or exfoliate that compressed imaginative language that we find in the tragedies. So that what's a figure of speech in the tragedies turns out to be an action, a monster or a prince or something like that in the romances. But this is the tragic moment within this play. And he speaks like a kind of compressed figure of a tragic hero or anti-hero. He speaks in images, and those images come back to undo him. Yes?
Isn't her speech more tragic?
Say, what you mean by that?
I don't know. Her speech on, where's deck 3-2, line 21, Hermione's speech, which she talks, I think that's the one I'm thinking of here, where she talks about all that she did and, I mean, I think that's false accusation, blush and tyranny, tremble and patience, all that stuff. I mean, you know, it's...
Why, tell me why you call it tragic?
Well, I mean, she's being accused of all these things which she didn't do.
Well, yes, it is tragic. The question is whether the language is tragic. The language is, I mean, she's describing a tragic situation.
Yeah, I guess I'm mixing up sad and tragic. I mean, it's...
Well, no, you're using the word perfectly appropriately. I was using it in a highly specialized sense, by which I only meant that that there was a kind of grandiosity to his performance of his emotion and the degree to which the emotion was fueling his language and his imagination so that we got out of him these great passages of imaginative language about the paddling fingers and stuff, where she basically says things like, it's not true, I am faithful to you, and so your life lies in the level of my dreams. She basically speaks to him, it's not that she speaks completely without images, But she does speak to him in a more straightforward realm of denying, quite accurately, you know, my faith upon the oracle, she says. Sir, you speak a language that I understand not. My life stands in the level of your dreams, which I'll lay down. And he says, your actions are my dreams. And that is literally true, that he has fantasized this, at least, unless, I mean, it's possible to imagine a production in which the child is, in fact, the bastard child of Polixenes. I have seen critics try to maintain this argument, but let's pause at least for a moment to think that this isn't the case, and that, in fact, the actions of Leontes in the first half of the play are, in fact, based upon his fantasy of what it is he thinks has taken place between her and Hermione. And as with all fantasies, it's a negative fantasy, but also a kind of a positive. I mean, he's engaged in this fantasy. He has made it his own. And he would rather have his certain, now maybe this is his kingliness, maybe it's the kings, can't be wrong, but whatever it is, he would rather have his certainty than, it turns out, have his life. And that is, say, his wife, his children, all the things that come around him. And so again, very, very quickly will come the oracle, that wonderful, wonderful scene that we can look at after break, maybe, in which the two emissaries go to the oracle and talk about how transcendent it was. And we will look at that when Cleomenes and Dian go to the oracle. But they open up the seals. Hermione is chaste, Polixenes blameless, Camillo a true subject, Leontes a jealous tyrant, his innocent babe truly begotten, and the king shall live without an heir if that which is lost be not found. So there's the riddle. The riddle's in the tale here. Every other thing is a declarative sentence that gives the lie to what he thought was the case. The king will live without an heir if that which is lost be not found. Sounds like an impossible condition. Because again, we don't know yet that which is lost is going to be the name of the king's daughter. That Perdita, which means that which is lost, is going to turn out to be the name of the daughter. So it is a coded message, but it's a coded message that no one, except everybody familiar with fairy tales, can already know how to interpret. With this, we'll pause and we'll come back in about 7 minutes. Okay, so welcome back. We left Cecilia in a bad state. The king was about to deny the oracle and to say, and we should really take note of his phrase there, there is no truth at all in the oracle. This is a case of his preferring to be right, of his preferring to have his own point of view somehow upheld. And what happens immediately after that? Yes, exactly. Exactly. He gets the news of his son's death, and that causes in, as a kind of domino effect, the sickness and apparent death of Hermione, right? So that we have son dies off stage. The prince, your son, with mere conceit and fear of the queen's speed, is gone. How gone? Is dead. Is dead. Apollo's angry, and the heavens themselves do strike at my injustice. Because it's seconds previously that he has said there is no truth at all in the oracle. The sessions shall proceed. This is mere falsehood. I think what we are meant to see here is not only something about belief and trust and love and narcissism, but also something about the king as sovereign and the king's command over all of these earthly elements, including the courts and so forth, the oracle is obviously over him, so to speak, but within his own Sicilian domain, he feels that he can disallow it as evidence. The king, the sun dies, Apollo's angry, the heavens themselves do strike at my injustice. So he's already willing to call it injustice, but it's too late. Hermione faints. Take her hence. Her heart is but our charge. She will recover. I have too much believed mine own suspicion. Well, gee, you know, mightn't you, if you were the playwright at this point, say, well, okay, Hermione doesn't have to die. He's already suffered one loss. He's repented of his previous rigidity and position. Beseech you tenderly apply to her some remedies for life. How do you understand or explain the fact that the news comes to him and also to us that indeed Hermione has also died? What kind of world is this? Sure. Doesn't he have enough punishment when Mamilius dies? Why is this piling on? Why also have the wife die when between the death of the son and the death of the wife, he says, I was wrong, Apollo was right, I repent of my injustice, take care of her, she will recover. What is it about the drama, what is it about the mode that requires or authorizes the death of the wife?
I think it kind of goes along with the idea that Mamilius is part of Hermione. When we talked about how his name means infant or something, so he's somewhat attached to her.
His name comes from the word for breast, as
right.
in mammogram, right?
But I also think that when you say, why does she have to die, well, I mean, why does he deserve her to live? And I think that she stands out to me as a very noble character, how she stands up, especially when I saw the performance of her standing up in this trial. It's a very moving performance, and I think that her death is almost as a martyr, and that he doesn't deserve to have her. So uh-huh. That's how I see her death.
Okay. Other comments on this? That's good.
I think... It's sort of about extremes. I mean, Leontes' behavior in his jealousy is extreme, and his suffering has to be extreme to kind of compensate for that. And Paulina kind of puts it into words with that long speech where she recites all the things that he has done done wrong, and it is the queen's death that is, she says, is the most
right.
The greatest charge against him.
Right, right. I say she's dead, I'll swear it, if word nor oath prevail not, go and see. If you can bring, now again, look at this also as prefiguring what will happen in the statue scene. If you can bring tincture or luster, I'm in Act 2, Scene 2, Act 3, Scene 2, about line 200. If word nor oath prevail not, go and see. If you can bring tincture or luster in her lip, her eye, heat outwardly or breath within, I'll serve you as I would do the gods. But, O thou tyrant, do not repent these things, for they are heavier than all thy woes can serve. Therefore, betake thee to nothing but despair. And watch that word nothing again, which is all over these first acts. A thousand knees, it's a great passage, 10,000 years together, naked, fasting, upon a barren mountain, and still winter, that is winter all the time, in storm perpetual, could not move the gods to look that way thou wert. So let me just pause with this passage a little bit, because one thing you can see is that this is the dark, hellish obverse of that scene of Boy Eternal. Boy Eternal, frisking lambs in the sun, always springtime, children together, and so forth. Here we have the same eternal, storm perpetual. You're going to have a storm all the time. It's always going to be winter. And a thousand knees, this synecdoche, this part for the whole. It's not 1,000 people on their knees or 500 people on their knees, maybe. But 1,000 knees, 10,000 years together, naked fasting upon a barren mountain. Now, this is in part a reference to a practice in the period of paying people to say masses for you, paying people to mourn for people who have died and so forth, that there is a cultural practice or a religious practice that involves giving alms or giving charity money so that people of a religious house will mourn on your behalf. You go about your kingly business and out there people are mourning for you. So this isn't a completely bizarre image, but it's way over the top in the length of time, the image of winter, it's always going to be winter. This still word, again, means stop time, as in Boy Eternal. and sorry, what's the other one? Storm Perpetual. So on the one hand, this looks back to that moment of the twin lambs and the boy eternal. It also looks forward to that fabulous passage in which Florizel talks to Perdita about how he wishes that she would always keep doing what she's doing, that I wish you would still so, always so, he says. When you do dance, I wish you a wave of the sea, that you may ever do nothing but that. His love talk to her is based upon this natural picture of something that happening repeatedly, as if it seemed only to be happening once, that it's happening eternally, because every wave looks like the same wave. And so he wants to imagine her dancing as being like the waves of the sea, in which they will go on forever and ever, that you will never do nothing but that. And this this moment of stillness in perpetuity is, in a way, a kind of reclaiming of these, of the unfallen moment and then the darkly fallen moment. Then this love talk in which he imagines the Florizel again with Perdita, the two young lovers in the Bohemia section of the play. He imagines her as always doing these beautiful things in these very graceful ways. And then when we get to the statue scene, we're going to see it again, in which what is still and perpetual also comes back to life, and comes back to life in exactly the way that she, that Paulina talked to Leontes in the passage that we just looked at, in the tones of impossibility. If you can bring color to her lips, if you can bring breath back to her, good for you, but in fact you're going to suffer forever. That's the moment that she leaves him at. And bear in mind that this is all her doing, that it's Paulina who instantly seems to have produced this plan, and it's Paulina who will undo it or fulfill it by revealing at the right time. What is the right time? The fact that the dead is alive, that the dead wife and that the dead stone are actually living and are actually the lost Hermione. So that all of these moments, I just want to show them to you because I'm just noticing them myself. I haven't really put all these things together ever before in my mind. But just sort of look at all of these moments in which the question of stopping time, hurrying through time, being stuck in time, for better or for worse, for heaven or for hell, is turned into a way in which time can be eternizing and changing at the same time. Because smack in the middle of the play is this allegorized figure of time who personifies precisely this set of thematics, this difficult tension between a timelessness that is dead and a timelessness that is eternal, and in between them, a timelessness that is a timeliness in which things keep happening over and over and over again. So the play manages space and time very beautifully in this respect, and there are clues at every single step of the way about what's going to happen. But you can't, you know, you again, if your ear is attuned to fairy tale or to romance, you can hear, again, the over-the-topness of Paulina's, you'll never bring her back to life, or I dare you to bring her back to life, and a thousand knees and so forth. You can hear that as a kind of promise, as a kind of impossibility that is about, nonetheless, to prove itself to happen. So, one other thing. Yes, Larry, were you about to rise? And please, yes, by all means. I'd love not to talk so much.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about, the fact that Hermione is in this other state for 16 years, is that she then doesn't have to suffer what her husband is suffering. On having lost both children at the same time, because by the time there was an opportunity for her to survive, because of his repentance, the baby was already gone, and the son was already dead, and there would have been the question during that 16-year-old period of the oracle not being correct, because there might have been a possibility of another heir.
Yes.
Of another child. So having Hermione be in this other state and away from her husband
right.
makes it so that, number one, she's not suffering because she's, in fact, innocent. And there's no need for her to be suffering the same thing that her husband's suffering from the loss of her children. But also, it makes it easier to have the oracle be
correct.
Well,
obviously, the oracle is tied into the plot of the play.
Right.
So that if she stays with Leontes, probably we're not going to have the oracle. But the question of, I mean, I've never seen a production that actually showed you, let us say, in Dumb Show, the private life of Polixenes and Hermione playing chess or something. I mean, it would be interesting to see a production that tried to imagine what the other life of Hermione and Paulina would be like. But of course, that would spoil the surprise for the audience. So that it is, to use a phrase from a different play of Shakespeare, to consider too curiously, perhaps, to imagine what her life is like. But if we were to imagine it, the loss of the two children presumably would weigh as heavily upon her as it does upon him, even though it's not, she doesn't feel the guilt, or maybe she does begin to feel a certain kind of inadvertent guilt. Yes.
I just have a question. What do you think? Do you think Hermione is really dead and that she's revived, or that Paulina has made
Oh, no, I don't think she's really dead. I don't, this kind of supernatural thing does not happen in Shakespeare. We saw the god Jupiter descend from a machine. You can see that kind of thing. But I don't believe, and Paulina basically says, I've kept her all this time so as to be able to produce her should the oracle turn out to be true, that is to say, if the lost child is found. But I don't think that there's any implication in the play at all that Hermione has actually been dead and comes back to life.
You say that Shakespeare never did that, but what about Empedocles, where she's dead and thrown in the water?
Well, she's not. What Saruman says is, gee, I'm a doctor, he says, and people are sometimes too hasty, and they think that somebody's dead because they cease to breathe. But there are certain signs of life that I'm going to check for. Oh, she's alive! So it's not that she's dead. It's that they made a mistake.
She's been in the water, though. Like, out at sea.
Well, but she's been floating in this light coffin, surrounded by all those wonderful things, the sweet things that they put into the coffin to honor her and so forth, and she washes up on shore. It's as likely that this happens as that his father's armor comes out of the water and he puts it on and dances in it. She's not dead. I think that the lines that Saruman speaks say, she was thought to be dead, but she is not. And I'm a doctor, and I have the authority to say so. So however likely this is, that's, I think, what the text is pretty clear about. And I think it's pretty clear here, too, that Paulina explains, and they're going to go off stage at the end of the play and talk more about how this could have been, what they were doing, and so forth. Yes.
There's a line toward the end of the play where somebody says, oh, come to think of it, I noticed that Paulina went to this
lots of times,
other house
absolutely.
Three times a day, and nobody checked for 16 years right, what she was
right,
doing.
Right. No, it's, remember Aristotle preferring a plausible impossibility to an implausible possibility. That we have to, that nobody asked Paulina where she was going all this time, that Hermione didn't get tired of the game, that, I mean, lots of reasons. 16 years is a long, long time. She might well have stalked off angry and then come back 10 minutes later and said, this is ridiculous. We have to sort of figure out how to make this marriage work, even though we've lost these two children. Who knows? We don't see that. But we do have a lot of this sort of this rationalization at the end, because nobody at the beginning says, gee, Paulina isn't around as much anymore. Oh, yeah, in fact, she's absent several times a day. Tell me about Paulina's name for a second.
From St. Paul.
From St. Paul. Okay, so why is St. Paul relevant here? Anybody back there? Nobody?
St. Paul's letter to the Corinthians and his other letters, he's trying to teach people how to be good.
Right.
And how to do the right thing. And that's Paulina's role in this play as well.
And we've already talked about Paul's letter to the Ephesians, about those who use strange arts and or magic arts and so forth, that there's this kind of naturalization and Christianization of magic here. It's also feminization. It's also a woman. who is, instead of Saramon, or instead, as we'll see next week, of Prospero, with no Mrs. Prospero, I mean, she's mentioned, but only very briefly, we have Paulina as the wonder worker. Yes, over here, please. Wait for the magic wand to reach you. Thank you.
The epistles of St. Paul, the first works of the New Testament, and are the ones where the resurrection is specifically laid out, coming back to life.
It's an overdetermined identity. It's a wonderful identity. There's no other Paulina anywhere in Shakespeare. It's very clearly a Pauline reference. But she's, again, she's not an allegorical figure. She's a wife. Whose wife is she, incidentally? Antigonus's wife. Okay, so what happens before we get to Bohemia, which we better do fairly shortly, what happens to both Antigonus and Camillo in Sicilia? Antigonus dies. Why does he die? He dies in Bohemia, but
he brings the
to Bohemia.
Right.
And
right. When we'll get to that scene in a second. Absolutely. Was he Leontes' first choice to do this job? No.
It was Camillo who just decided he wasn't going to do it and he was going to decamp to Bohemia.
Right. So Camillo, this is the classic case of sovereign authority gives a bad order, and the question is, are you obligated to respect it or not? Camillo says no, and what happens to Camillo at the end of the play? Marries Paulina, lives and is reunited with his old master. Antigonus says, yes, I will obey earthly authority. Antigonus dies. Again, very common doubling in productions of Antigonus and Camillo, so that the Paulina winds up married to the same guy twice, so to speak. But she too suffers as a result of this business. She too has her life disrupted, or so it would seem. And so we are off finally to Bohemia, where first we have the depositing of the child. Before we have the grown-up child, we have the child deposited. And immediately you'll notice that the scenery, not the literal scenery, but also the dramatic scenery changes. Because who lives in Bohemia? Shepherd, clown. What does the word clown mean, incidentally? Sorry? Bumpkin, his country fellow. Doesn't mean, you know, a comically employed circus member. It means a guy from the country with straw in his hair, or a kind of a natural, foolish guy, unpolished manners, things like that. Shakespeare has many clowns. The first gravedigger and the second gravedigger, for that matter, in Hamlet are called clown in the speech prefix. It means guy from the country, rather than professional funny man here, though this guy, in fact, is quite funny. This is where the shipwreck scene happens, and where the death of Antigonus happens as well. Let's maybe look at that just really quickly. At the end of Act 3, Scene 3. What's the verse form here, incidentally? It's mostly prose. It is not absolutely always the case that common people in Shakespeare speak in prose, but it is often the case. And here, this great speech by the shepherd that I do want to remind you of, about line 59, right after exit pursued by a bear, the most famous stage direction in all of Shakespeare. A savage clamor, well may I get aboard, this is the chase, I am gone forever. As he's putting down the baby, this being indeed the issue of King Polixenes, he seems to believe it, should be here laid, either for life or death, upon the earth of its right father, so I'm returning it where it belongs, blossom, speed thee well. There lie and there thy character, that is to say, little document that I put in with the character's handwriting. It only later assumes that sense that we have of a of a human character or personality, but in this case it's a kind of credential that he has put next to her, and also gold. Now, why gold? Yeah, exactly. It's in the hope that somebody will adopt her because of the gold. So it's instrumental as well as emblematic. It is, so to speak, metaphorical and metonymic at the same time. She is gold-like, but also the gold is going to help her to be a different, you know, to grow up. That it's gold is an image of her, and it's also an instrument that will help her to move forward. Shepherd, I would there were no age between 10 and 12, or 10 and 3 and 20, or that youth would sleep out the rest, for there's nothing in the between but getting wenches with child, wronging the ancient tree, stealing, fighting. Hark you now, would any but these boiled brains of 19 and 22 and 22 hunt this weather? They've scared away two of my best sheep, which I fear the wolf will sooner find than the master. If anywhere I have them, 'tis by the seaside, browsing of ivy. So notice that he's looking for sheep. He's looking for lambs, and he finds one. Good luck, and be thy will. What have we here? Mercy on us, a barn, baby. A very pretty barn or bairn. A boy or a child, I wonder, that is a boy or a girl. A pretty one, a very pretty one, sure some scape. Though I'm not bookish, yet I can read waiting gentlewoman in escape. Some backstairs work has happened here. This has been some stair work, some trunk work, some behind door work. This is the child of some illegitimate liaison amongst servants, he thinks. They were warmer that got this than the poor thing is here. I'll take it up for pity, yet I'll tarry till my son comes. He hallooed but even now. What ho, 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 and in comes the clown. And the clown has had a different kind of discovery, hasn't he? What has he seen instead? The shipwreck. Again, terrific passage. Let's just read it again, because the backing and forthing is so great, about line 89. I would you did but see how it chafes, how it rages, how it takes up the shore. But that's not to the point. Oh, the most piteous cry of the poor souls, sometimes to see them and not to see them. Now the ship boring the moon with her mainmast, and anon squalid with yeast and froth, as you thrust a cork into a hogshead. And then for the land service, that is what's happening on land, what's being fed on land, to see how the bear tore out his shoulder bone, and how he cried to me for help and said his name was Antigonus, a nobleman. But to make an end of the ship, to see how the sea flap-dragoned it, treated like a raisin in a burning punch. But first how the poor souls roared and the sea mocked them, and how the poor gentleman roared and the bear mocked him, both roaring louder than the sea or weather. We have two events happening at once, the shipwreck in which all the other people die, the violent death of Antigonus, again, as retold by the clown. Why, if you are the playwright here, do you have this as retold narrative rather than as something beheld? Again, often in productions, they actually show you Antigonus being attacked by the bear. But why strategically might it be a good decision for the playwright to put this in the mouth of the clown?
Because at least I think the description is so incredibly vivid. The bear tore out his shoulder bone, and I mean, it would be very difficult to get it sufficiently bloody on stage, I think, and it's very bloody here. I mean, it's just you can really see all too graphically the bear kind of munching on Antigonus.
What keeps this from being a moment of visceral recoil? If anything does. Yes, right next to you.
The fact that they decide that they're going to bury him.
Oh, well, there's that too, yes, but I really meant the way the clown is, I mean, that this antithetical account of the kind of comic similes that the clown uses, the equations of the two things, if you actually were to see this, it would, you know, it's the wreck of the Titanic, and it's this some kind of horrendous Hannibal Lecter-like, you know, bloody thing. But in fact, it's told as a kind of a tale. It's told as a kind of a narrative. You see the clown, you don't see either of these horrendous things. You get he can't seem to make up his mind which story he's telling about. He winds up with this evenness between the sea mocking and the bear mocking, both roaring louder than wind or weather. So you get this kind of allegory of nature, of storms and of animals and so forth, but you don't actually see them. Yes?
I think you also really get a sense of what kind of people they are by finding out that they are willing to take in this child that they find, even, you know, with the gold and everything, but also bury this man before the clown goes on to be torn apart by Autolycus, who just steals his money and, you know, makes
yeah,
him
no,
like
there,
an idiot.
There's the scene ends very quietly with this piety. And again, there's another equation there. You've got the dead man and you've got the living child. And so they want to do honor to both of them. And they're going to keep the child from dying. They're going to pick her up. They're going to take her home. But they're indeed going to bury. Just remember the boys burying the dead body of Cotton in the Cymbeline, too, that this kind of the doing honor to the dead. And again, where the piety seems to come out of this, the native simplicity of the noble savages, again, of the people who haven't been tainted by the court and who have more humaneness about them than many figures that we already saw in the court. So that you have that closure of, and the shepherd talks about luck too, and about how the burial, the behaving in a Christian manner, is going to give them good luck, and they've already got good luck because of the money. And the money, in fact, transforms them, because the next time we see them, they've actually got a big house, and they're having it really, there is a material change in their situation. It's not just that they bring Perdita back, and they're all scratching away on the same three crackers. The money's actually functional in this regard, and makes for the Bohemia world as a much more open-handed place, and also a place where, indeed, as you say, Autolycus could steal things from the clown, because the clown has something to steal, which would presumably not have been the case previously. Yes?
I was just thinking that the way the clown does describe it, and the way that you were talking about it, that the poor souls roared and the sea mocked them and so on, there is something about the clown's delivery that brings you to that place that's just kind of on the edge between horror and laughter.
Exactly.
Just kind of right there.
Right. We talked about this a little bit when we talked about the Dover Cliff scene in King Lear and what it meant for an actor who thought he was on the verge of Dover Cliff to jump, and in fact for us to see that there was no cliff and so forth, and that how does this moment of unbelievable despair, how does the inadvertent comedy of this undercut or in fact expand the kind of pathos of this moment, and how does the playwright manage it? And this is a quite similar moment, I think, in which you're getting a different complex of emotions being mobilized here, because you're not merely confronted with something horrible. In fact, something horrible is always off stage here. What you're getting is it being already made into a kind of a tale, a kind of a narrative. And we're going to move right into the Bohemia world, where they're buying ballads, and where the ballads that they're buying about the woman who was turned into a cold fish and so forth are not unlike this story that he saw, with the man being torn apart by the bear and the sea tearing the ship apart and so forth. This is going to be naturalized into a kind of fiction by being told and then by being sold when we get to Bohemia, when at the feast, in fact, one of the prize things is ballads being sold. And one of my favorite lines in all of Shakespeare is Mopsa's line, where she says, "I love a ballad in print, a life, for then we know they are true." That if it's written down, it must be true. You know, read your newspaper, it must be true. So I want to leave some time for us to talk about the last scenes, and I'm very mindful of there being a class that comes in after us. But let's say just a few things about Autolycus and about the sheep-shearing scene, if we can, before we get there. What is the role of Autolycus in this play? Or how much you describe the usefulness of a character like this to the play.
Is he kind of like a lord of misrule?
Oh, that's good. Yes, that's a very nice idea. And what? Hang on to that. Tell us all what a lord of misrule is, and tell us why Autolycus is such a thing.
He would be the one character in the court who would be allowed to say whatever was possible. He could be a little bit bawdy. He could tease the king or the queen.
Ah, that's the fool. That's what a fool does. That's what the court fool, the allowed fool, does. Lord of Misrule is the world turned upside down, king for a day, topsy-turvy world, and so forth. Also, he can do what he wants, but it's not because it's a festival moment. It's a feast moment, and this is indeed a feast. Great. Okay. Terrific. So here we have Autolycus. How does Autolycus describe himself? What's a snapper up of unconsidered trifles? What does it mean? What does he do? He's a petty thief. It's exactly what he is. He's a petty thief. And he steals household goods. He steals money. He steals sheets off hedges in that kind of wonderful description that, for me, is always also like the snow coming off the hedges and bringing the springtime. He's a kind of a natural spirit at the same time that he's a kind of a countercultural figure. He's definitely... even at the end, remember that when they offer him a job, preferment in the court, he says, "No, I want to stay true to my nature. I'm actually I'm an outsider, not an insider. I'm against rather than for. I don't want your gift of inclusion. I want to remain who I am instead." And he's a figure also of music, and a figure preeminently maybe of eroticism and sexuality. That his songs are all about bodiness. That there's about maids and plackets. A placket is an opening in a skirt, so that the question of sort of stealing things not only from pockets but from plackets means that you're stealing not only money but also virginity or sexuality. That there's a sense in which he and the songs, the red blood in the winter. Let's try to see if I can remember the line from his song. Rains, I think, rains in the... Sorry? Winter's pale, thank you. The red blood rains in the winter's pale. But again, remember, we're in winter. We've been in winter. It's winter's tale. And here comes the red blood, here comes the spring, here comes the desire, the eroticism, all that stuff that nature and indeed the people need in order to get out of that business we've got. Thousands of people kneeling over here in Storm Perpetual. We have Hermione supposedly dead. We have Leontes frozen in a posture of repentance. And over here in Bohemia, suddenly we have life. And we have life as energy. Yes?
Mm-hmm. I just thought of another meaning of lamb, the paschal lamb. So that would be a sign of spring.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, what is a sheep shearing? What happens in a sheep shearing? Sure, sheep, but what do they look like? What happens as a result? You all have shearling coats, I'm sure of it. What is it?
The winter growth of fleece is shorn from the sheep in the spring.
So you transfigure. It's a natural caretaking behavior that actually is a kind of a natural. I can't say rebirth, but it's taking off a certain kind of costume for the sheep. And they're beginning all over again, so to speak, with a haircut. There's a sense in which this very activity, which is a seasonal festival, is also a kind of natural transformative activity. And there's much that's going on that's naturally transformative in this fabulous scene, Act 4, Scene 4. Who attends this feast? The notion of the pastoral visitor is crucial to some pastoral kinds of poems and verse. Somebody comes in from the outside and who is able to, therefore, observe what's going on and to be a kind of explorer or investigator. In this case, who are the visitors or the explorers or the investigators?
The king and what's his name came with it.
Yeah, Polixenes and Camillo, exactly. Dressed like themselves?
No, they're in disguise. Too.
They're in disguise, yeah.
Exactly.
In many productions I've seen, their disguise is very disguise-like. So you're not sort of trying to think which is the old shepherd who's the real shepherd and which is the old shepherd who's Polixenes, but you have this sort of mustachioed figure who is there. In any case, they're coming. You know, what are they doing here? Why have they come to the sheep shearing feast?
To spy.
Sorry?
To spy.
To spy, exactly. Spying on whom?
Beautiful girl who they don't... Well, I'm not sure if they know she's the shepherd girl. They're suspicious of this
right.
girl's background.
Right. So Florizel, the son, whose name means flowering one or something like that, has fallen in love with Perdita, the shepherdess. He's, again, it's a high-low thing. Supposedly it's king, falls in love with the shepherdess, very familiar. And they go off to sort of suss out the landscape and see what it is that they can learn about this. And at the feast, and I'm going to have to go very quickly here, I see, at the feast, Perdita is the queen of the feast. That she, you know, again, it's one of these, to go back to the Lord of Misrule business, this is one, again, shepherdess becomes the queen. Now, in fact, she's really a queen. She is rather shy about the father, the person she thinks is her father, the shepherdess. Shepherdess says to her, you be queen of the feast. She's quite shy about playing the role of queen and of being the welcoming figure and so forth. She's very, very, very mindful of her own place. But she nonetheless gets into this conversation with the visiting shepherd, Polixenes, in which one of the great exchanges in all of Shakespeare takes place, the conversation about nature and art. And if I can quickly find this in Act 4, Scene 4. Thank you. Why can I not find it? Yes, indeed. Okay. This is the giving of the flowers. Again, those of you who know Ophelia in Hamlet will know the tragic, mad version of the giving of the flowers here. Sir, welcome, it's my father's will I should take on me the hostess-ship of the day. Here's that theme of hostess that we saw before. Give me those flowers there, Dorcas. Reverend sirs, for you there's rosemary and rue. These keep seeming and savor all the world winter long. We have heard the same thing from Ophelia. Grace and remembrance be to you both, and welcome to our shearing. Shepherdess, a fair one, are you? Well, you fit our ages with flowers of winter. The winter theme again. Sir, the year growing ancient, not yet on summer's death, nor on the birth of trembling winter, the fairest flowers of the season are our carnations and streaked gillivores. Those are our tulips. I think, if I'm correct, which some call nature's bastards. Of that kind, our rustic gardens barren, and I care not to get slips of them. Wherefore, gentle maiden, do you neglect them? For I've heard it said there is an art which in their piedness shares with great creating nature. Say there be, he says, yet nature is made better by no mean, but nature makes that mean. So over that art which you say adds to nature is an art that nature makes. You see, sweet maid, we marry a gentler scion to the wildest stock and make conceive a bark of baser kind by bud of nobler race. This is an art which does mend nature, change it rather, but the art itself is nature. Now, this exchange is a set piece. These ideas about nature and art are familiar in the period. Shakespeare doesn't invent this dialogue between nature and art. He doesn't invent the language. But what's, of course, striking here is that Perdita wants purity in her garden. She doesn't want a mixed marriage, high-low, and she thinks that's unnatural. Whereas Polixenes precisely thinks that you make the plant stock better by grafting on a wild with a tame, a sophisticated with a naive, a high with a low. So each of them, of course, is arguing the opposite case from the case that they want in romantic human terms. She wants to marry somebody she thinks is a prince. He wants to prevent this unequal marriage. But on the level of nature, they're making the opposite argument here. And what happens at the end of this scene? How does it get interrupted? Yes.
That Autolycus is out there selling ballots, right, starts to take over the scene.
Right, exactly. And then you get all the ballad stuff. And what is it that actually drives the plot back to Sicilia? We wind up back in Sicilia. Yes.
Camillo was anxious to return home after all this time.
Right.
And so he suggests to Florizel and Perdita to go there. They would be safe there.
Right. We're taking for granted the fact that the king has unmasked himself, has forbidden the marriage and so forth, and that they're going to flee, and he's going to flee. Camillo's going to flee with them. No. All right. Okay. So Act 5, Scene 1, the young couple come back to Leontes and crave lodging with them. And he does not, of course, know who the girl is. And he is disposed to do them a good turn. Act 5, Scene 2, conversation between, and that's the scene in which he falls in, he develops a crush on her, and Paulina says, no, she's not for you. The Act 5, Scene 2 is the scene in which the two gentlemen, or the several gentlemen, the four gentlemen, talk about what happened off stage. And what is it that happened off stage? The recognition between who and who?
The father and daughter.
Father and the daughter. Okay, so great. So and who was most marble there changed color. It's a wonderful figure of speech that turns out to predict what's going to happen in the next scene. But this is an as-told-you scene. Again, it happens off stage, and it nicely, dramatically subordinates that reunion scene. Because dramatically speaking, two of these reunion scenes would be really, really hard to keep the emotional intensity. And now we get finally to the statue scene. And let us get to Act 5, Scene 3, therefore, where Paulina has them showing the statue of our queen, her dead likeness. Line 17. Here it is, prepare to see the life as lively mocked as ever still sleep mocked death. Behold, and say 'tis well. And there's the statue is revealed. I like your silence, if the more shows up off your wonder, but yet speak. First you, my liege, comes it not something near, doesn't it look like her? Her natural posture, chide me, dear stone, he talks to the statue, that I may say indeed thou art Hermione. Now he still thinks this is a figure of speech. He doesn't really think it's Hermione. He thinks it's just like her. But he uses this metaphorical language. Chide me, dear stone, that I may say indeed thou art Hermione. Or rather thou art she in thy not chiding, for she was as tender as infancy in grace. Infancy meaning couldn't speak again. And again, that purity image. But yet, Paulina, Hermione was not so much wrinkled, nothing so aged as this seems. Oh, not by much, says the loyal Polixenes here. Oh, she was gorgeous when she was young. Paulina, so much the more our carver's excellence, which lets go but some 16 years and makes her as she lived now. So the carver is Shakespeare, the carver is time, the carver is Giulio Romano, the sculptor, who knows. I am ashamed, does not the stone rebuke me for being more stone than it? O royal peace, there's magic in thy majesty, which is my evils conjured to remembrance, and from thy admiring daughter took the spirits, standing like stone with thee. So notice that that Perdita has temporarily become like stone in looking at the image of her mother, whom she never saw. Give me leave, and do not say to superstition that I kneel and then implore her blessing, lady, dear queen, that ended when I but began, this is the daughter speaking, come give me that hand of yours to kiss. Paulina, no. O patience, the statue is but newly fixed, the color is not dry. Let me pass on a little bit here to line 59. Do not draw the curtain, says Leontes, no longer shall you gaze on it, lest your fancy may think anon it moves. Let be, would I were dead, but that methinks already, what was he that did make it? See, my lord, would you not deem it breathed, and that those veins did verily bear blood? Masterly done, the very life seems warm upon her lip, the fixture of her eye has motion in it as we are mocked with art. And I'll draw the curtain, says Paulina. You've had too much. This is really overkill. No, he says. Make me to think so 20 years together. I could afflict you further, she says. I could make you even madder. Do, Paulina, for this affliction has a taste as sweet as any cordial comfort. Still methinks there is an air comes from her. What fine chisel could ever yet cut breath? Let no man mock me, for I will kiss her. Good my lord, forbear. The ruddiness upon her lip is wet. You'll mar it if you kiss it. Stain your own with oily painting. Shall I draw the curtain? No, not these 20 years. So long could I stand by a looker on, says the daughter of Perdita. Either forbear, quit presently the chapel, or resolve you for no more amazement. And don't think, she says, that I'm assisted by wicked powers. What you can make her do, I am content to look on. What to speak, I am content to hear. For 'tis as easy to make her speak as move. And here, Paulina, finally, it is required you do awake your faith. Then all stand still. Or those that think it is unlawful business I'm about, let them depart. Proceed, no foot shall stir. Music, awake her strike. 'Tis time, descend, be stone no more. Approach, strike all that look upon with marvel. Come, I'll fill your grave up. Stir, nay, come away. Bequeath to death your numbness, for from him dear life redeems you. You perceive she stirs. Oh, she's warm. If this be magic, let it be an art lawful as eaten. She embraces him. She hangs about his neck. That she is living, says Paulina, were it but told you, should be hooted at like an old tale. Remember, the play is called The Winter's Tale. But it appears she lives, though yet she speak not. Mark a little while. Please you to interpose, fair madam. Kneel and pray your mother's blessing. Turn, good lady. Our Perdita is found. And this is the moment at which Hermione speaks. This is the moment, finally, at which the statue comes to life, that the mother speaks to the daughter. The statue coming to life, I'll just leave you with this, is the perfect Shakespearean inset of what a Shakespeare play is. It is the work of art that is a completely crafted object that comes to walk and speak and recognize upon the stage. And this is a Shakespearean art object within the art object, so to speak, if not a Shakespearean play within the play. The statue moves, it comes to life, it has always been alive, and it comes out and greets the observer. We'll see the same in a different way in The Tempest next time.